did a I've done a gig in a military encampment, essentially,
for ISIS.
Well, look, I don't ask too many questions, Ben. I just, you know what I mean? I see it as entertainment. It's
everyone, you know, needs it, doesn't
everyone they? Needs it. I don't judge. You know, an audience is an audience. But I did a gig where I had to be driven through military checkpoints to get into a military base. It's a military base, basically. It was a UK military base.
What was the big idea?
It was an absolutely ridiculous, terrible booking mistake. And, you know, it really made me worry about the state of our army, frankly.
Because of their lack of appetite for surreal whimsy. They're not training
exactly.
Them, right?
You've got to be able to think outside of the box. And this is route one, and your enemies are going to be all over this. It's very, very obvious. You know what I mean? Come on, guys. I think it was a Christmas gig as well. I think it was some sort of Christmas sort of. I don't know what it was.
God, the army was relying on you to decompress these veterans before sending them back to their families after a 9-month tour.
I think they wanted something that was somewhere between as enjoyable as fighting in Afghanistan and civilian life, and they thought half an hour with me, yeah, something to bring them back gradually.
Yeah. The exact perfect halfway house.
Yeah.
And was it was it kind of like squaddies, or was it more like kind of like the officer
top
class,
brass.
Like corpulence going
or staff college?
Yeah, wearing huge sort of tricorn hats and.
No, it was. It was very much. It was a mixture. To be honest, it was the squaddies. It was mainly squaddies, but there was a few top brass as well who were sort of mucking in with the lads, and you know, it was clear that they all liked each other. I got that sense.
Okay, that's something. Sometimes a sort of common enemy will strengthen those relationships.
I did see that the speed with which they were able to, identify me as an enemy, I thought was quite encouraging.
And unfortunately, you were unable to call in an airstrike of humour.
That's right. And in fact, I really needed certainly my confidence could have done with a military medevac.
A humour Chinook.
Humour Chinook. Would have been handy.
That sounds quite intense.
But I tell you what, it was terrifying. I think going into a gig, I think somewhere in the back of my mind, mentally, whenever I've done gigs in the past, I've actually always, not consciously, but I've always known, actually, looking back, what my physical escape route would be from that room if I had to get out of it within, say, 60 seconds. You know, I could get out. If this goes really badly, I can get out.
It's the sign of a true pro.
It's the sign of a true... So you check the toilet windows, you're looking for access to alleys, you want a clean thoroughfare, ideally not through the audience, but if you have to barrel through the audience... Yeah.
Always make sure you leave the engine of your Hyundai i10 running outside.
That's always running. Always running.
Often it's through the kitchens as well, isn't it? Through the kitchens, smashing over big piles of plates.
That's
and
right.
Some
bewildered sous chefs wondering what on earth is going on. Yeah.
I've got. I've always had to employ three dummy Henrys that can deploy. They can be released so that essentially the idea is. Yeah. And ideally, more for bigger venues, more than that. The idea is...
Yeah, those rapid inflation ones that you can set off with remote control button on your belt.
That's right. And eventually, for some of the bigger gigs, I'll employ actual actors. And the idea is that they're looking for Henry. Where's Henry? We want to lynch him. The guy who was on the stage, we want to hurt him. We're not sure exactly how yet, but we're
not going to stop until we can taste his blood.
we want blood taste. That's all we know. Carol here, she insisted on blood taste. We all agreed with it, didn't we? Yeah. So at that point, ideally, what you do is you release a troop of actors who are playing me. So then the venue
Henrys.
flooded with decoy Henrys.
And soon flooded with the blood of the decoy Henrys.
Flooded, because the audience will make the only decision it can, which is we're going to have to taste everyone's blood here. Just to guarantee that we have tasted some of Henry's blood. So, yeah, it can escalate. But I've always had that thing of I think it's important just subconsciously to know there's a window there, there's a customer toilet... I can get through. I can, if I have to barrel my way down into the sewers.
You got your pneumatic drill with you in your bum bag.
I've got my pneumatic drill in my bum bag. But some of the worst gigs I've had. I remember once I did a gig. I think it was a trials for the Hackney Empire comedy competition. Do you ever do that one?
I didn't do that one, no.
No.
And I don't know why. I think I went in for the others, but yeah.
It was one of the many new act competitions that there are, and it happened at the Hackney Empire. And the green room was positioned in such a way that it was basically behind the stage. There was a tiny window that you could never get through. And the only way out was to walk basically over the stage pretty much and up through an aisle through the whole audience. It was a very long, long room to get out the back.
The gauntlet.
The gauntlet. And I thought, well, the gauntlet's there. All you can do, Henry, is pick it up. That's why you're in this game.
Yeah. I mean, that's why you always perform in running spikes, isn't it?
That's why.
To this day.
That's why. And I have the microphone stand, which is adaptable, which is telescopic and turns into a pole vault. and I can pole vault over pretty much any bar. Unless it's pre-Victorian, some of the very, very tall, tall medieval castle bars, I'll struggle with.
But that's why you've always got your backup. You always make sure that you're tied by a very taut bungee to the nearest fire exit as well. So it's, your core is incredible these days.
It's extraordinary.
Because if you manage to get through the whole set with that line around your waist, just simply have to relax and out you ping straight through the thing and out you go.
So I can bungee myself sideways, essentially across a shiny floor, a bit like air hockey, but with a person. I can sort of puck myself. So I can get out of all sorts of situations. In an emergency, although a lot of the time makes the gig ironically makes the gig more of a struggle, which is because there was a lot of time the audience think, why isn't he referring to all this equipment that he's got on it? He's just launching in some quite tepid observational material. Why isn't he referring to the huge harness?
Why is he tensing his abs so much? I can see them through his shirt.
Yeah. Why is he bollocking the tech guy that hologram backup has failed? What's the yeah?
Also, how many girdles is he wearing?
And is that James Nesbitt dressed as Henry Packer? Why is he crouching by the side of the stage?
Must have fallen on nine times a year, but apparently it's a really high-paying gig. It's danger money. So
it's equivalent to deep-sea oil rig fixing. but in the comedy world.
He just wants a bit of winter sun and he needs some fast cash.
Oh, God. Yeah, so that Hackney Empire one was one where it's like, you know, I'm just going to have to do well in this because if this is bad. And I remember during the gig, as you know, within the first 15 to 25 seconds, I felt the gig hopelessly falling away from me. And there was absolutely nothing I could do to save this.
Those first impressions.
Yeah.
I mean,
I was screwed.
They count.
But I thought, I'm going to have to walk through the entire audience to get out of here. I mean, I probably should have been concentrating on trying to rescue the rest of my gig. I mean, there's 6 minutes left of my set. But I was really thinking, I need to get out. Plus, the other thing is I'd left my bag in the back.
Oh, that's gone.
And sometimes I've got to sacrifice.
You're just going to leave that behind.
Lose the bag.
Yeah. And the person you're dating who's there as a guest. It's all just got to go.
Yeah, it's got to go. That person, they're not getting back in touch with you.
Your mum, treasured uncle, they're all there.
They came to support, but yeah. We all know. In fact, I saw my mum give me a little nod. Which was to say, that's it now.
Was it like the nod of the gif of Robert Redford doing the little nod in the woods?
Yes. It was exactly like that gif, but imagine if the emotion was just pure malevolence and disappointment.
It's got a fatalistic tinge to it.
Yeah, with a fatalistic tinge. So that was what I remember noticing that feeling as I went into that military gig, because it was literally no escape. As we went through the barriers.
Well, you're not getting out of there unless you want. They want you to get out of there.
Exactly, yeah. Right.
They've got a few Alsatians who are going to have something to say about that.
Yeah. And I think that really added to the kind of fear, the sense of doors locking, ka-chunk, behind you.
Yeah.
Ka-chunk.
Would you have great escaped it on a motorbike?
Ooh.
Over the walls?
You might have needed, I assume, a sort of crash course in riding a motorbike first.
Yeah.
It's hard to organise in the middle of an escape.
Very hard to... It's very, very hard. No, I think I just had to accept that, you know, this is what it is. It's happening. It was bloody awful.
I've only ever done one military gig, and that's that wasn't stand up. That was years ago. Sort of student sketch troupe got invited. Have I talked about this before? We got invited to do a sketch performance at an RAF base in Anglesey.
Oh, my God.
Have I not told you about this?
Sketch comedy is hard at the best of times, isn't it, to pull off in a live situation?
Never mind student sketch comedy, right?
That is absolutely honking. Yeah, that's a...
We had no idea how high risk that was. And it was quite an interesting experience because we arrived the night before. They wanted us to come the night before to sort of set up and all that kind of thing. And when we got there the night before, we were shown through to the mess. And it was a kind of... They used it as a training base as well. And these trainee pilots, they took us through to the mess. And they were literally listening to the Top Gun soundtrack at the loudest possible volume. And all still in their flying onesies. And they looked so abashed when we came in. They're like, oh, well, we don't normally do this. Said, of course you do this. Why wouldn't you do this? We would do this.
Down, 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 down. That one. Down, down.
All of them.
Down, down, down.
The whole thing. Playing and playing with the boys. Yeah.
Yeah. Good stuff.
Loggins in it up.
That's hugely embarrassing.
But then the next day, the trainee pilots, they were quite a welcoming crowd. And they even took us on a little tour the next day. I had a lovely, lovely time.
Well,
but then
course,
on when it came to the main event, they were there, but so were the officers and the rest, the senior staff. And we had one song that was about the Queen Mother.
Oh, no, Mike. Pull that one from the gig. Look at the set list.
Because we were edgy, right? We said the unsayable. Okay?
Oh,
there's nothing stopping us. It didn't occur to us that we were in a base of the Royal Air Force and that there might be some people there who were into the Royal family. And
so when you were pulling on the Queen Mother outfit costume, that, was anything going through your mind of like...
Nothing. Mostly just thinking, oh, Pag's got a wicked line in this. They're going to love this. This is going to be on a trick.
And even when you were unfurling the seven dildos? The seven prop dildos?
Nothing at all.
Yeah.
Nothing at all. But I think the squadron leader sneaked out and he set off the fire alarm.
What?
And it was a powerful heckle.
Wow.
Just got off his seat, dusted himself off, made sure his creases were in the right place, marched out round the back.
Ba-dong! During the Queen Mother song?
Yeah.
Bloody hell.
You thought that was the most effective way of bringing it to a close, which it was, to be fair. I mean, these guys, you know, they know how to respond in a crisis.
So was the fire brigade called?
No, I don't think so, because I think they could sort of do what... They might even have their own fire brigade. I mean, on these... bases, they can do what they're little kings, right? They can do what they like.
So there's a fire alarm went off. You heard it.
Yeah.
And was that the end of the gig, the whole gig? Or just that sketch?
Oh, I think we had a realization of what had happened. So we were allowed back on stage. And I think we then did a sort of fairly pitiful final number in front of a very disapproving audience.
And did you then have to
did you try and improvise a kind of pro-royal...
A pro Queen Mother sketch.
And you can never return to the island of Anglesey ever again.
No, that's it.
So do you reckon the Air Force boys and girls, do you think they're a bit different from the sort of infantry, what do you call them? Land squaddies? from land squads?
I don't know. It's a different thing. I don't know, because I've never been in these.
Was there a romance to them? Did they have a kind of...
They have a romance to them. They have a slightly different thing, don't they, where they're...
Are they a bit posher?
I guess the thing that they have, and this has been often talked about, is that with the army, the officers will sit in a nice... And this is probably going to get a complaint from an army officer listening, but my understanding is if you're an army officer, then you stand in front of some little maps with some little sort of toy models and stuff. And you say, run over there.
Yeah.
Mike, as they're listening, someone has just smashed the fire alarm in Aldershot.
Exactly.
Some officer has just, with reflexes, just smash.
Yeah. Whereas in the RAF, it's the officers who are physically in the thing that's going to be fired at, right? And all the non-officers who are sort of, you know, pumping up the wheels and all that kind of thing.
Oh, is it? I see. That's interesting.
Whereas in the Navy, they're all together. All of them are on the boat. So if the boat gets sunk, they're all going down. So there's a slightly different attitude, I think. Slightly different culture in each one.
Oh, God, that's
true. This is all secondhand, you know.
Do you think there's room in the 21st century for a bit of outside-the-box thinking and a fourth military...
Space Force?
Well, what would it be? Like, we've got land, we've got sea, we've got sky.
I think, by the way, if it was Space Force, I think it should be called Space Force 9. just randomly, just nine. I think would be good. Space Force 9.
Vibe so. Force? We do have cyber, don't we? I don't know what.
Cyber squad.
Oh, yeah, cyber warfare. I reckon we might go down quite well at a base for cyber warfare operatives. That might be our niche in the.
Maybe.
Sort Maybe of nerdy nice. Computer people.
I'd be up for that.
You know, last time we recorded, you caught me doing my morning admin.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you were leafing through bills.
That's right. Well, and there was another bit of morning admin that I was in the middle of, which you stopped me from doing. So, A, this bill, I still haven't leafed through properly.
Okay.
Look at that. You can see it's not been leafed.
Yeah.
And also, the other bit of admin I haven't done, which is another thing I do, is extract. I have one hair that grows from the centre of my nose.
Okay. I was wondering why you're rubbing your nose throughout the entirety of
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Because so, what I do is I
try and coax it out with gentle rubbing.
Yeah, you gently coax it to start with. Yeah. It's very much like if you've ever hunted a moray eel. you can't go in all guns blazing. You coax. You sweet talk. Mm-hmm. You befuddle. You bemuse. You amuse. You
you confound.
You confound. You mesmerize. You entertain.
You bribe, and then you strike.
You stab.
And then you strike. You stab. You gut. You behead.
You steam.
Steam. You defin.
You garnish, and only then can you say
that you have an all-weather scarf. For the first time in your life, you have a scarf which is just as appropriate in summer as it is in winter. Autumn. Suits all occasions, formal, informal, sport.
But will attract protesters.
But will attract virulent protesters. And rightfully so. But it's very similar with my nasal hair. So I've just got one.
But it's not coming out of your nose. Just make this clear. It's not a nostril hair.
Mm. Oh, no. Oh, no. I mean, I could talk for hours about that. I mean, let's not even go there. That's a whole... I mean, that's literally a separate sub-series. So I coax it, I think about once every fortnight I extract. But it's part of my morning routine. It's bills, parking fines, visa applications, a lot of longhand correspondence. I'll be normally talking to a couple of emigre writers.
Has your Belarusian visa come through yet?
No, not yet. They still use 19th century technology. There's a lot of rubber stamping, a lot of steaming of envelopes, a lot of melting of wax, of stamping through wax.
And your telegram machine needs servicing as well, doesn't it?
That's right, yeah. It's very hard to get the parts. Obviously everything has to travel by hawk to and from Belarus. And hawks are notoriously impossible to train.
Because they all speak Belarusian, of course.
They're an entirely Belarusian species. It doesn't matter how many times you've watched Kez, at the end of the day, that's more of a parable about the North. actually, in terms of what you can actually take from it to actually train and work with a hawk, it's not that useful. Plus, it's about a kestrel. They're not.
Oh, and don't even get you started on peregrine falcons, eh?
Please don't. Please don't. I don't want to get this angry this early in the morning. I just don't. Yeah, so that's why I do my correspondence. I have my letter dagger. Mm-hmm. I have this. I've got my backup. This is actually a letter dagger and human dagger.
Oh yeah, your Freemason stiletto.
it's my Freemason stiletto, and I do all that stuff. Oh yeah, and then one of them, and then there's the extraction. Do either of you have a nasal hair or any sort of particular?
I've got a forehead straggler.
Oh, okay. So, is it one? Because this is one.
It's one. You know, it's quite silvery, and it appears I don't notice it until it's about 4 inches long.
Yeah, I've got one on my thigh.
Mm, lovely.
Really? Yeah. I think everyone has one.
Yeah.
So you've got a thigh straggler.
Yeah, and like Mike, I work, obviously it's on my thigh, so I won't notice it, and then suddenly I'll have a sort of 8-inch long hair.
Yeah.
Thick, coarse.
Yeah, like a
greasy
weird...
hair.
Yeah.
And it's strange to think, isn't it, that in a way... We are just the custodians of these hairs, but they will long outlive us, and they will continue growing long after we perish.
I think that's a myth, isn't it? That your hair keeps growing after you die.
It is, yeah. And I think, Henry, haven't you illustrated a textbook that that busted that myth wide open? Or was it fingernails that you did in that book? Maybe it was fingernails.
I can't remember, but I think either of those is probably true.
Hats off to any part of my body that keeps growing after my cremation.
Just a single hair protruding from a pile of ash on the mantelpiece.
There it is, that beloved thigh hair.
It can't be burned.
But yeah, no, so it gets to a certain point and then I extract it. But I have a thing, I notice these things on other people and have a real, very, very hard to contain urge sometimes.
Well, that's why I've never shown you my thigh, Henry, because I know what you do. You'd be straight on.
That's
it.
That's right.
With and the tweezers.
Whenever we've gone scuba diving together, anything, you always, don't you? You have a special.
He's always in the long trousered wetsuit, isn't he?
He's always in
there. Right, when you're in your Boy Scouters.
Henry's got the wetsuit hot pants.
Look, I just want that reef to know what's heading. You know? Hi, yeah, whoa, hello. Yeah, why not look fabulous? Yeah, why not? Ooh. Yeah.
The reef is a vibrant place.
The reef is a vibrant and very permissive place. It's very, very laissez-faire. It's very easygoing. The only thing is that anyone could eat you at any time just for no particular reason at all. That's all there is. But it's not.
Also, crucially, you want the moray eels to think you're there for a good time and not to spear one of them and turn them into an all-weather scarf. So.
Exactly. And I was just going to say, the moray eel scarf with the scuba hot pants is dynamite.
It's time to turn on the bean machine. This week's topic, as sent in by Rowan.
Thank you, Rowan.
From Bremen.
Mm-hmm.
Is forests.
Forests.
The dark forests of Central Europe. That's not what they say. They just say forests.
But it's implied, isn't it? The dark forests of Central Europe, if you just say forests. Have you actually been in a forest properly?
I'm gonna stun you by saying, yes, obviously I have.
Yeah, I second that. Yeah, you probably have been too, Henry.
Henry, I know the thing you're getting often. At. Maybe.
Yeah.
When I'm in a forest, you're obviously on a path that has been sort of created, either
that you've been warned not to stray from.
Yeah,
exactly.
But when you do look off the path, it does look pretty mad in there. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, there'll be attractive young ladies going, I'm not a crone, come hither.
Come hither.
Come hither. Yeah. I'm not a crone. Then there'll be crones.
The beady eyes of a centaur on the other side peering.
Yeah. Being ridden by a crone. And the crone will say, I am a crone. I am what I appear. A crone. So essentially anything that looks like a crone is a crone, and things that don't look like a crone, there's a good chance they're a crone.
Absolutely. I guess the nearest to me that I would visit would be the Forest of Dean.
Yes.
But you stick on the path.
I stick on the path, yeah, because we know what happens when you stray from it.
But I hardly ever feel I'm in a proper forest. Like this is real. Like, you can always see through the forest. You can always see the car and the Tesco's.
Yeah. No, I know what you mean.
You don't want to see a dog poo bin anywhere, you're saying.
Exactly,
you
yeah.
But there's always direction.
Yeah.
No wood chip paths. No zip wires.
Yeah, it's the visitor centre sort of ruins it, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So what you long for is the forestry wilderness, basically.
Well, I say I long for it. Oh, I don't say I long for it. But I wouldn't mind tasting that, even if it's just being dangled into it in a secure cage from a helicopter for a couple of minutes. But, you know, I wouldn't want to be properly lost in the forest, obviously. But
there was a TV show, I think in America. I can't remember what it was called. But at the beginning, they would drop in two people into the middle of the jungle. I'm not sure where the jungle was either. I think South America. And the twist was, well, the game was you have to get out of the forest, you have to find your way out. And the twist was you're both naked.
Ooh.
And I think it was called Naked and Alone, I think. And basically, when you think about it, first of all, you think, well, that's all right. It might be okay.
The mushroom fairies are naked. Look at them.
Exactly.
They're proud.
But what you forget about is the sheer number of insects trying to get up your ass.
Because in the same way that you are terrified of the forest and looking to find a small dark cave to hide in, the insects are in exactly the same situation. Yeah. They feel exactly the same about it. So your ass is, it would be the equivalent of walking into the lobby of a good...
Four-star hotel.
Mid to low-level four-star hotel for those insects. So we're talking...
The kind of four-star hotel where you go in and you go, is this four-star? I think this is a three-star. Really, it's a three-star.
It says it is on Google Maps, but otherwise there's no other proof.
But you know what? We're on holiday, so let's just get on with it and have a nice time.
In this man's ass.
Going up your ass, yeah. It's like those insects will be like, you know what? We probably could have done better. Like maybe being like a wild hog's ass.
But we didn't book ahead, so we can't be picky.
Yeah, just got to make do.
So I've looked at the TV show. It's called Naked and Afraid.
Yeah.
It was on the Discovery Channel. Each episode chronicles the lives of two survivalists who meet each other for the first time naked and are given the task of surviving a stay in the wilderness for 21 days.
21 days? It sounds like the sort of show that must have been cancelled at some point following a catastrophe, surely.
Each survivalist is allowed to bring one helpful item, often a machete or fire starter. What would you go for, Henry?
Pajamas.
Pajamas.
I'm not a PJ wearer.
Yeah. Not even an extremis.
No, I never wear PJs.
You get chilly though, don't you?
I do get chilly. But there's something about PJs it doesn't work for me.
I think I would probably go for a Gresham.
Yeah.
You got 21 days of chilling out in the forest.
Really take your time with it.
But also you can smack an insect with it, you know. So it's
And probably the other person's brought something useful like an axe or something.
Yeah.
So you can lean on them a bit.
You know what I'd bring? I would bring a roll of kitchen roll.
Just for mopping up spills?
For mopping up nasty spills and keeping those surfaces shiny because you've got to maintain your standards. No, I think I'd bring a kitchen roll. I found kitchen roll hugely useful. I'm always using it. I get through it really quite fast. So I just think that there's always call for it.
You could fashion a decent outfit, absorptive outfit out of it, couldn't you?
Yeah.
Fashion a little tent or a bivouac.
Pretty much
fashion a small camping stove. Fashion a companion for the lonely nights.
The whole lot.
What are you taking, Mike?
Or maybe one of those inflatable armchairs.
That would be good.
Because you're going to want to relax at some point, surely.
Well, that's why I got my Grisham. But now I'm thinking about it. What am I going to sit on to read the Grisham?
Mike's inflatable armchair.
This is how the team goes wrong, isn't it? Mike's on his inflatable armchair with nothing to read. And there's Benjamin dangling from a branch upside down trying to read his Grisham.
While Henry mops up.
I just make sure everything's just so.
Mike, I'll give you a go on my Grisham.
Yeah.
You can have an hour a day of Grisham time. In return for 6 hours on the inflatable chair.
6 hours for one. 6 hours of chair for one of Grisham. But I know you're going to be reading your Grisham when you're in the armchair.
Yeah.
That's outrageous.
That's the deal. Do you want it?
No deal.
Oh, no deal. Fine.
I'm going to imagine my own Grisham.
It can't be that hard.
I'm going to give it a go. I'm going to sit on my inflatable armchair. And I think, she was magna cum laude at the top law university in North Carolina, Florida.
This is the best Grisham I've ever I've ever heard.
Okay, do carry on.
This is a top Grisham.
The top firms were queuing up to hire her, but she chose to go with one little rinky-dinky firm who said that they were going to be campaigning for human rights for people on death row in the Mississippi Delta.
Can I just say something? I'm massively behind this rinky-dinky firm. I don't know why, but for me it's like, I really want this rinky-dinky firm to be a success.
Or to have a secret going on where it's not actually as rinky-dinky as we think.
Exactly. That's what's coming, Henry. That's also, they think they say they're rinky-dinky. They say they're ethical.
But they're actually rinky
Donk.
They're rinky dunk.
And that's the title,
donk.
The Rinky Dunk Attorney.
Okay, so, and then I guess her first day is probably the first chapter?
First day goes like a dream. She makes a great friend. Her name is Charlemagne. She's going to get killed later on.
The friend's called Charlemagne?
Friend's called Charlemagne, yeah. Okay. She's just a local girl. She's a paralegal. She sees something fishy in the documents she's copying, and she smuggles it out to try and get it to her handsome young journalist.
And she dies on page 274. With Grisham's, you can literally, you know the page, yeah, don't you?
She'll be the, she'll be so the page 200. That's when you know that it's really hit the fan.
The page 274 death.
Yeah, and you're quite the page 274 friend death. As well. You like her.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. She's funny. She's a bit kooky. She's the one who persuades our hero to just put her hair down once in a while, and they go up there and eat some beer. Yeah. Yeah, and they get hit on by some right wallies in a bar somewhere. And Charlemagne nuts one of them, and they leave him alone, and they go off in Charlemagne's Cadillac and throw bottles into a lake. Have a great night. And then it's back to the case.
What do they throw into a lake?
Bottles.
Is that also the one where they sort of lie, something you can never really do in Britain, I think, is you sort of lie down on the bonnet of your car and,
yeah.
And look up at planes coming over?
They do that. It's shooting stars, though, for this, because they're on the Mississippi Delta, and they don't want to ruin the nighttime skyline with planes.
No.
Okay,
yeah.
But then,
on one night, there is a plane. Hang on, what's that plane doing there? We're in the shooting star lane. Why is there a plane in the shooting star?
This is a no-fly zone.
This is a no-fly Delta zone. It's a small craft with Venezuelan insignia.
Oh my god,
what the heck.
She remembers that from when her dad was a Navy SEAL and he would teach her the insignia of aircraft. If only he were still around.
And that then she puts two and two together, you see. It's the aircraft, and it's something that Charlemagne said before she was squashed in what looked like just a timber accident. Just some timber accidentally fell out of a small Venezuelan aircraft onto where she was trying to get into her Cadillac, but she doesn't think it was an accident at all.
This wasn't just a simple run-of-the-mill timber falling off a plane and crushing someone on a car. Something else going on.
And any other lazy-minded person would have just taken that as read, but she's got a razor-sharp mind. She's whip-smart. Yeah. You understand?
Yeah. Whip-smart, this kid. Whip-smart.
You're crazy. That happens all the time round here. People are getting flattened by timber falling off planes every day.
Well, my own mama was by some beach planks out of a Panamanian twin engine.
Well, she nearly survived it, but then a shard of frozen piss finished her off. straight through her eye.
Now, why don't you sit down and eat some peaches with me? Oh, peaches. Sweet peaches.
Glass of peach juice on the porch?
On the peach porch? With my peachy wife.
I'm already drinking a glass of Mama's fizzy nectarine juice on that special sofa that goes on chains that goes
nectarine
up and down.
Juice? Why, you ought to get yourself to Kentucky with your nectarine juice. This is peach country here.
Now, I actually don't know about the world of Grisham, to be honest. Is it all this, it's southern, is everyone sweaty? Is there a lot of descriptions of the heat?
Everyone's often sweaty, but they look great.
Yeah. Okay.
There's no sweatbands going across, you know, horizontally across people's midriffs. None of that.
Okay.
There's just glossy sheens.
Because one of the main differences between books and films is that you can't see everyone all the time in a book. So,
well, that's why they're careful to make sure that all of the books are also films, so you don't have that trick.
Okay, so you can actually, if you need to reference it, you can reference across.
It's recommended, in fact, that you watch the film. It's the other way around with the Grisham books. It's recommended that you watch the film first so that you can clearly visual Matthew McConaughey.
Yeah, it's always Matthew McConaughey. Yeah. And he's filmed in a light film of sweat because it's hot.
Yeah.
And he's drinking
peach juice. Yeah. Ice peach juice.
And is he sitting on one of those special sofas?
He will do in one of the reflective scenes.
Okay.
At his lowest moment when he thinks he can't do it.
Okay. So what you have to do is, but obviously it's a book, in book form, they can't be telling you everyone's sweaty all the time.
It's pop-ups. They're also pop-ups. There'll
be pop-ups all there.
Quite sweaty, sort of moist pop-ups.
Okay.
And often quite extensive footnotes where it will just say, yeah, he's still sweaty.
Yeah. So,
in case you're wondering, yeah.
Still sweaty. So you can look down, you can just glance down, can't you?
Yeah.
Still sweaty. The fan is still turning, making a chugga chugga noise. You'll be reminded of that in the there's still flies around which are being swatted away.
Very few flies. If there are flies, they only tend to trouble one character, who'll tend to be sort of the comical, fat and competent local mayor.
See, that's what I'm picturing. I'm picturing the fat, incompetent local mayor in this sort of world, he always sweats worse than everyone else.
He sweats, he sweats in an unsavory manner, and he's plagued by flies,
constantly dabbing his brow with a big hanky.
Because it's a sweat sort of all books have a kind of language whereby certain physical attributes have a moral sort of equivalence. Mm. So in 19th century novels, it's all about the size and shape of your forehead.
Right. Right.
That lets the character know, that lets the reader know what the character's like. So it'll be like, he had a wide, noble forehead. That means he's a wide, noble person. Or he had a knobbly, mean little forehead. That means he's a knobbly and mean little person. Whereas in the Grisham world, I'm assuming it's all sweat-based. So the sweat was literally pouring off his horrible face.
It's sweat in the scholarships. Yeah, yeah. If they're not sweaty at all and they had a good scholarship, they got into the best law school through a scholarship, you know they're absolutely top draw hero.
Okay.
Right? If they're not sweaty but there's no mention of a scholarship, they're probably an arch villain. If there's no scholarship but they are sweaty, trustworthy, but ultimately useless.
Okay.
Scholarship and sweaty, second fiddle, going to die on page 274.
Okay, so scholarship
that's
and sweaty
the
means that...
That's the sort of... That, yeah. that,
okay.
The two-by-two two matrix.
Page 174, you're going down. And how often is the death, because they're so sweaty, they can't get purchased on something, they slide off things or they
only
they
in
fall
first
down.
Drafts, apparently. Very rare, the rare okay. Grisham folios, can you find those?
Okay.
And then someone points out, let's not waste this on a slippery banister. No. Let's use this okay. death.
Yeah.
Let's make it suspicious.
So I do need to actually read a Grisham, I think. What do you think should be my first Grisham?
I think one of the ones that's a good movie.
So you're talking okay. the Firm, Pelican Brief.
Pelican Brief.
So that's a good one, is it? That'll get me up to speed.
Well, I don't know. They're just two I can think the names of right now.
Okay. Okay.
With Grisham books, Henry, it gets to a stage where there's so many of them, you're measuring them not in novel titles, but more in kind of weight or just in pages. Yeah. You're just doing some Grisham. Do you know what I mean? It's like using 200 grams of flour. It's not...
Yeah, or getting your 10,000 steps or whatever it is, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's almost like...
a certain number of units of Grisham, yeah.
It's a homogenous mass of... It's not like, you know, like certain things are measured numerically. You can have like... You know, you can have five chickens.
Mm. Yeah.
But you can only have... But you can't have five chicken dishes. Oh, no, hang on a minute. No, you can have five... You know, you can't have five breads.
We can.
You can't. You can have five loaves of bread, but bread and like it's like you can't have 10 milks. You know, milk is it's unmeasurable. It's the same with Grisham.
Yeah. So why are you rejecting my example of flour, which I think was a good example?
Yeah, exactly, mate. Yeah. Nice one. Yeah, no, I'm not rejecting it. I was trying to add to it by copying it and giving less clear examples.
If anything, you're strengthening my earlier example.
I just wanted a piece of it. I liked it so much, I wanted to be part of it. I sort of saw your flower comment as a bit of a gang, and I want to be a member. And so I've tried a bit too hard to get in on the...
And then it became increasingly clear why you'd never been invited to be a member of that gang.
I would never be invited to be a member of that gang, which simply would never happen because... I can feel I'm just annoying. So I see what you're saying. Yes, so
you'll enjoy a length of Grisham.
Yeah, or for example, you might say to someone, "How much Grisham are you bringing on holiday with you?"
Yeah, and they'll do it in grams, probably.
Yeah. And they might sometimes measure it in books, but that's just one of the many ways. And some people might go, "So I don't measure it in," but that's imperial. Can you use metric? Because to measure it in books is quite old-fashioned, isn't it?
That's 17 legal suspense qubits is what I'm saying.
Yeah, that's another way of doing it, yeah. Or, you know, because they're good for killing flies, basically, as well, aren't they?
Well, in the Naked and Afraid context, absolutely, yeah.
So you could measure it in how many flies you could kill. So how much Grisham you bring on holiday? 450,000 fly deaths worth, or whatever. It's just, and also, when where one ends, same with flour, where one ends and when another one begins isn't really a...
Flour is a really good example, actually, of that.
Great example. but also things like no, flour is the best. I was going to try again. Where does one end? When does it doesn't matter. It's just and that's the other thing is you can read them in any order. You don't have to read from page one to the end. You could start in the middle, go backwards, start. You don't even have to hold it the right way around necessarily. Do you? Do you have to hold it the right way around?
I think somebody who isn't on the inside of the Grisham world would say to Mike maybe, "Oh, what's that you're reading? Is it The Runaway Jury? And Mike would just answer, doesn't matter. It's not, sorry, that's not really the question, you know?
Yeah. It's a bit like if you say to someone, I'm eating some bread at the moment, and they say to you, which bread is it? What do you mean?
Well, you could. You could say it's a nice ciabatta or it's a...
Yeah, you're right. You could. Can I just say, Ben, I really admire how good you are at this. I think it's brilliant, and I know I can't do it, but...
I think it's just something to work on in your own time. Really,
it's something for me to work on my own time, but I just wanted to do... Yeah.
I mean, I think definitely there's a kind of... There's also a liquid equivalence that you could start working on, you know?
Yes.
Oh, that might ease him in.
Yeah.
How much beer have you got? What do you mean? I don't know.
It doesn't feel quite as good. I mean...
No, it doesn't work. Yes, so that's... it's a Grisham. It's almost... Yeah, it's just a sort of... it's a bag of flour, isn't it? It's a bag of flour that you take on holiday with you.
It's a bag of flour. And I'm going to enjoy my own little Grisham on my inflatable armchair.
Well, it's Ben's armchair.
No, it's Mike's armchair.
Oh, it's Mike's armchair.
But because Mike's able to self-generate Grishams...
But Ben wants it.
Mike's in a kind of nirvana state where he can now generate his own Grishams. So
yeah.
He needs for nothing else. You've cut out the middle Grisham, really. Yeah.
Which is why they're after me. It's my life is now like a Grisham thriller in and of itself.
If Grisham finds out that there's a man out there who can dream up his own Grishams...
Whew.
I'm done for.
He'd think, I'm going to get a bloody good Grisham out of this.
The pretender.
All he'd have to do is turn Mike into a lawyer who works in Kentucky. Is that right?
It's not bad.
Yeah.
It's not bad at all.
And top lacrosse player.
When you send an email, you must give thanks to the postmasters that came before.
Good morning, postmaster. Anything for me?
Just some old shit.
When you send an email, this represents progress. Like a robot shoeing a horse.
Give me your horse.
My beautiful horse.
Okay, time to read your emails. If you'd like to send us an email, send it to 3beansaladpod@gmail.com.
Yes, please.
This is from John. Hi, guys. Your chat about pest control a couple of weeks ago. Henry, by the way, how's that going?
I can tell you there's been a few different stages to this, but I can tell you that there came a point where we realised we did not have a mouse or a rat problem.
You had a mouse and rat opportunity.
Reframe it. So we talked to a really interesting pest guy from pestreframers.com. And he completely made us rethink the way we prioritize our space. So now I live in the recesses of my own flat. I can crawl. Actually, it's not that difficult. I can crawl from the bedroom to the bathroom in under a day.
You do a lot of rat laundry, don't you?
Do a lot of rat laundry because they are. I tell you what, they're sociable, but they are dirty. But the fact is, as was explained to us, the rats are a highly intelligent, highly sociable species. There's more of them than there are humans in London. And actually, you're closer to a rat than you are to the other rats most of the time within 5 metres at any one point in London. So that kind of thing really made us rethink stuff. I keep an eye on them. I can look. There are various little holes that have been drilled, so I can still see what's going on in my flat. Yeah. And the rats are, they've created a sort of rat kingdom in there.
They always tend to go for the sort of monarchy, but you always hear about rat kings, never a rat democracy.
That's right.
That's true.
No, that's
they've given you leave to remain as well.
They've given, yes, exactly. We are, well, we're officially exiled, but there is not a, there's no imminent risk of being executed.
Right.
Rat babies are allowed to if they can get into my throat, they are allowed to eat it. So
just, but, you know, get breathe through your nose for the time being.
It is nose breathing for now, yeah.
So this email from John is about someone who's taken a very different path to you, the less enlightened path, maybe. So your chat about pest control a couple of weeks ago reminded me of my partner's aunt's experience during the waning days of lockdown. If anyone remembers, tradespeople were difficult to book as the world opened up, and she found herself with a rat living in her kitchen. She eventually tracked down someone through the back channels of her odder friends, who turned out to be a man from Ammanford with some rather unclear credentials.
Yes, it's quite a murky world, actually, pest control. Mm. It is.
Let's see. When he arrived, she showed him the poison and traps she tried to catch her little guest with, of which he was quite dismissive. He began bringing his own equipment in from the car and suggested she take her dogs to the sitting room. Good. It's a good sign.
Is he about to release an alligator?
With a chainsaw. Like,
there's so many different approaches to pest control. There isn't a kind of agreed orthodoxy on how to do it. So it's quite Wild West. Go on.
After a while, there was a very loud pop.
Electromagnetic pulse.
Bursting them.
And some disgruntled swearing. My partner's aunt stuck her head into the kitchen to find the guy laying siege to the back of the fridge with a large air rifle.
Oh my god.
Picking them off one by one.
But with more of a smarting pain, not killing them, just giving them a kind of warning shot.
She insisted he couldn't fire guns in her house, to which he responded by asking if she had a broom or mop he could borrow. Furnished with the broom, he fashioned a spear by taping his knife to the handle with electrical tape.
Wow. Bloody hell. Gone Rambo.
Suffice it to say, several hours later, the rodent remained at large. But 2 days after the man's unsuccessful departure, fell prey to one of her elderly shih tzus. All the best, John.
That's a lovely, lovely email. Fell prey to one of her elderly shih tzus. That's really got a sort of Alan Bennett quality.
It really does, yeah.
That's wonderful.
Suffice it to say, several hours later, the rodent remained at large. 2 days after the man's unsuccessful departure, fell prey to one of her elderly shih tzus.
And now it's time for Pompidou section. Pompidou.
Pompidou. Pompidou.
Hello.
Hi, Mike. I'm just editing this week's episode of Three Bean Salad.
Oh, yeah?
And there's just a bit where I launch into a impression of Alan Bennett. Don't know if you remember that bit.
Yeah, vaguely, yes.
I just don't think it's a very good impression. I just wanted to apologise.
I don't think anyone's got very high expectations of your Alan Bennett impressions. And I think as long as it's clearly labelled, you're okay.
But I don't know. It just feels like when a podcast gets to the stage where it's just doing like really poor impressions of Alan Bennett, it feels like it's maybe on its last legs a bit. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, the podcast is on its last legs, absolutely. I mean, as long as no one realises that, I think we're okay.
Yeah. Okay, well, if you think so, yeah.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, well, thanks, Mike.
Yeah, all right. All the best.
Bye.
Hi, Ben.
Hi, Henry. I'm just editing this week's episode of Three Bean Salad. And I don't know if you remember, there's a bit where I did an impression of Alan Bennett.
Oh, yeah. I do remember, yeah.
And I'm just ringing around to apologise because I don't think it's a good enough impression of Alan Bennett.
Okay. I think it probably wasn't, was it?
I think we were all having fun. Like, the idea of Alan Bennett talking about a rat being killed by an elderly shih tzu was fun.
Yeah.
But then the reality of me actually trying it as Alan Bennett, I really screwed the pooch, I think.
Yeah, well, I think you're probably right. I think you probably did. And I'm not going to lie, it has, you know, it has stayed with me how bad your Alan Bennett was. It's been playing on my mind. It's cast quite a long and quite a deep shadow.
Yes, I'm just apologising to you, apologising to Mike. I'm obviously apologising to the listener. I haven't cut it out because I feel like we need to be accountable.
It's one of those things where we should probably keep it as a warning, shouldn't we?
Yes, a useful warning for sure.
A bit like in the old days when you know, they'd catch a smuggler, hang him, and then they'd stick his corpse in a metal gibbet and hang it from a high post so it would slowly decay.
Yeah. Okay, well, I'm going to get back to the edit now, but I just wanted to let you know and yeah, and just say sorry actually to you personally.
Appreciate it. I'm not going to say apology accepted, but I'm going to say apology acknowledged.
Okay, I get that. All right, I'll see you next week, Henry.
Bye.
Bye. Okay, sorry about that. Back to the show.
And I remember thinking, oh, I must remember to get some more custard cream.
Hello, Benjamin.
Hello, Henry. I'm just continuing the edit, and this is something I'm sure you knew, actually, when we just spoke, but yeah. As soon as I finish my Alan Bennett impression, you yourself do a dog shit Alan Bennett impression. So all that stuff you were just saying to me about me being hung on a gibbet like a smuggler, and you knew that you'd done exactly the same thing, you bastard.
Oh, fuck, have I just effectively signed my own gibbet warrant? Oh, no, I think you're probably right, aren't you?
Yes, I'm just here to... Can you also apologise to the listener and then we can move on?
Yeah, I'm really, really sorry to everyone. Not good enough. I've let everyone down. I'm sort of feeling a bit like I've let Alan Bennett down. Did you feel that?
Yeah, I think that's actually at the heart of all of this, isn't it? But he's just a lovely old man, and yeah, I don't know what we were doing.
He's just a lovely man, and you know, at the end of the day, I'd hate him to have to actually hear it himself, you know, and end up, you know, saying something like, "Oh no, I can't believe it,
Henry, no, I'm hanging up, I'm hanging up." Back to the show.
That's fabulous.
Yeah, what a I tell you what tale.
By the way, to quickly finish off my own pest control experience. What's actually happened is we've decided it wasn't rats and mice. We decided it was squirrels because of the quality of the sort of the quality of the sound. Oh, also I spotted some squirrels
having a shower.
I spotted some squirrels behaving suspiciously in the
loitering.
Loitering
with a set of your keys.
With a set of my car keys. And it turns. I think it was squirrels. And what we decided was they were doing. We because we were sort of monitoring their sound patterns, time of day, and nature of the sound. And we decided they weren't doing. They weren't living there. There wasn't any sort of. It wasn't home building. It wasn't. Mm-hmm. But we decided that it was basically the only conclusion we could come to was that they were holding a kind of large scale squirrel sporting event in our ceiling space. So between our two floors. So we think basically some sort of squirrel Olympiad. So some sort of squirrel Olympics. Because it was running up and down. It definitely had the pattern of competitive sport. We wanted the hosting rights. We wanted marketing opportunities. No. This kind of thing could be huge.
We're on board.
Yeah. Yeah, Gillette were on board. You know, some people will call it squirrel washing. I don't agree with that.
But Henry, what will the legacy be?
Well, I think every squirrel should believe it has the opportunity to become a sports squirrel. You know what I mean? Because you can only be it if you can see it.
Yeah. And you've now got piles of squirrel shit in your attic for generations to come.
Huge piles of it. For generations to come to enjoy. Yeah.
Grassroots.
Exactly, it's grassroots stuff. But no, they were scurrying up and down so fast, we thought it has to be some sort of competitive race. So we thought they were using it as a kind of leisure space. And they were going, and then at night they were going. So we thought, you know, that's like, you know, a sports stadium in the day when the night will be deserted, won't it? I mean, it all adds up.
They're going back to the athlete's village.
Where they're rotting.
Even though they've been told they shouldn't.
Even though they've been told they shouldn't, but, you know, when you're...
You've got that many buff squirrels in one place.
Exactly. I mean, to be alive during the Squirrel Olympiad, but to be alive, young, buff, and a squirrel. You know what I mean? You've got to enjoy that. But actually, then what happened was, and a bit like an actual Olympics, the day after it's finished, dead. The whole place is dead. And they've gone. They seem to have gone. So it's a happy ending.
Golly.
And obviously, it'll just be a question of who's applying for that one, the next one in 4 years. Will it be in the Middle East? Yeah, we'll see.
Thanks to all our Patreons, or patrons on Patreon. Mm-hmm. I'm not quite sure what the nomenclature should be.
Thank you very much.
Thanks to all of you over on patreon.com/threebeansalad. You can get ad-free episodes. You can get bonus episodes that we do every month. And if you sign up at the Sean Bean tier, you get a shout-out in the Sean Bean Lounge, where Mike spent a long, lugubrious evening last night.
Sure did.
Well, it was the topical glass-blowing roulette.
it was and which was spectacular, and here's my report. The stakes were high last night at the Sean Bean Lounge as we indulged in a night of topical glass-blowing roulette. Francis Ashley Lopez was established as the new lounge croupier, the position having been made vacant following the disgrace and expulsion of former croupier John Wiles, who claimed he knew the rules of craps but whose no trousers at the table decree made it clear that he did not. Constantine Felix Dunham Mansa opened play with a perfectly blowpiped ball of soda lime glass, which landed on Belgian swimming pool vandalism. Michael Colville put everything on Peruvian inflation, but his free blowing was underpuffed, and he accidentally glazed cybercrime and Icelandic mackerel quotas. Muriel Heslop Harrison cast a rainbow centaur with satin finish, which smashed onto undeveloped building sites in the northwestern province of Zambia and doubled her money. Emboldened, Tom Carroll put everything on European car import rates into South Korea, but his borosilicate abstract egg cup melted into school funding in the Cocos Islands, costing him his house, his laptop, and his uncle's Nissan Micra. DWLX raised eyebrows by marvering his hot mould directly on the spinning table, but an even spread of bets across the Malvinas question, cruise ship parking in Venice, and Teutonic nanostates meant not leaving the lounge empty-handed. However, it was Holly Chandler with the big win of the night after her offhand lamp-worked shit ornament ricocheted and shattered its way across the table, its central trunk finally coming to rest right where she wanted it on the proposed expansion of Kickapoo Turnpike, Oklahoma. We hadn't even pulled the glass shards from our foreheads and cheeks before she'd ordered 4 jet skis. Congratulations.
Okay, time to go. Let's see whose version of our theme tune will play us out. This is from Cooper. Here's a recording of me banging out the Three Bean Salad theme tune on various pots and pans from my kitchen.
Brilliant. Thank you, Cooper.
Superb.
All right. Until next time, goodbye.
Cheerio. Thank you. Bye.
Thank you. Bye.